preserving the hearing, as I foreshadowed Stelzman, I want to discuss issues of scope with you, because as you will have detected when I read your first legal submission describing what you are now proposing, I scratched my head and thought, well, that's interesting. How does that fit in with the original submission? Hence my email, message that I asked, a friend of ours, to forward on to you, and thank you for the detailed point by point issue about scope. First of all, I should say I don't have a particular issue about moving from a residential zone to an RL zone. I understand the argument. It's the balance of the relief sought that make all the provide all the positive benefits to overcome the adverse effects. But I'm concerned, essentially, as for the same reason as in relation to the easement, as to whether we can rely on them. You've stated in relation to the protection areas that the submission applied to the whole of the Allenby land, and if Allenby were going to in effect profit constraints on their ability to use their land, how can that be a scope issue? In effect, is that a fair paraphrase?
I'd add that the original submission not only addressed all of the Allenby land, but made specific reference to protecting the ecological aspects of the Allenby land. Which is the basis of my submission that on the ecological side of things, potentially excluding Little Mount Island, that the scope of the original Allenby submission had scope to cover all of the ecologically related aspects of the case on the original Allenby land.
The problem I had reading that submission was that I went back to the Allenby submission, which I have under my elbow, which says at point six, the land which is the subject of this submission is the northern part of the Allenby Farms property, including Mount Iron and Haddon Hills. So I suppose tell me what I'm missing, because it seems to me, on the face of it, that the submission is confined explicitly to what is now the proposed RL zone.
Well, I would point to the following sentence, the Commissioner, which gives the legal description and then talks about particular parts of the land subject to the submission being identified in the plans attached, which effectively covers, if you have the plans attached, virtually the entire Allenby property. I mean, in fact, one has to say that the sentence you quoted actually doesn't match the following two sentences, because the following two sentences make it very clear that the submission extends to cover the entire Allenby property, given that we're seeking removal of, amongst other things, the BRA adjoining the road in the Wanaka, which is the far southern aspect of the Allenby land.
Yes, I could
And that second sentence is actually incorrect.
Yes, but you'll understand that it gives me a difficulty.
Well, I think, again, realistic, workable, and so on, commissioners, I mean, you know, this, I don't think it's a chancery draftsmanship, and, you know.
You shouldn't be so modest, Mr. Goldberg, about your drafting.
Yes, I will say, in, for what it's worth, that the days and weeks leading up to the lodging of submissions to this plan were just horrendous. We were sitting there with drafts of submission after submission after submission after submission after submission, trying to get them all right. So, where the northern part of the Allegheny Farms property came from, given that the submission very obviously looking at the maps applies to the whole of the Allegheny property, I just call that a typo. That would be very legally nice, I think, to constrain the submission on the basis of that one sentence.
You understand that I'll need to think about that.
Yes, I can't say much more than that, so I mean, that's, the plans are there, there are aspects of the submission that cover the entire property. The ecological values, there's a specific reference to the SNA and changing the SNA, that covers, as I said in my submissions, all of the protection area, the Ngarama protection area, apart from that little 2.3 hectare area. It would be, I think, straying into legal licensing to suggest that somehow that one sentence governs anything.
Yes, I know.
Particularly as, to be fair, you know, where the houses are going hasn't changed. And that's probably part of what was in mind with that sentence. The way houses going in one part and there's a whole bunch of other stuff happening in the other part.
Now, in terms of proceeding on, you've drawn our attention specifically to the enlargement of the SNA, or the alternative SNA.
Is that my little map?
Yes.
Appendix 2 over there. Appendix 2. Amended SNA.
Yes, and did I tag, hopefully? Oh, yes. The 2.3 hectares. And you said, well, on the scope issue, that's a minor mapping anomaly. Is the corollary of that that we could accept that as a minor mapping anomaly and add it in anyway, whatever else we did?
You mean if the existing SNA would be retained?
Yes.
Yes, I don't have a problem with that. I mean, it's a minor area. Dr. Lloyd identified it as, you know, went back and said that the area should have been included. I'm not going to say it or fall on that 2.3 hectares.
And the other question is, looking at the map, I was trying to reconcile against the original plan. There's like a, on the right hand side, if my direction's right, the southeastern corner, there's a chunk between the notified SNA and the dock land. Is that an addition to the SNA? Because I was looking at the profile of your notified version seems to be.
No, you're quite right, sir. There's another little area there.
Yes, sir.
You're right. There's another area there of maybe another 2 hectares that is being added in, which was not identified in the.
Yes, indeed. That's what I'm talking about.
I hadn't noticed that, sir. I think I'll make the same submission about that as the 2.3 hectare area.
think.
Just make sure we're all on the same page, we're all at the same place. Now,
yeah, it did come up, and the question was asked when we were doing some work, and it just made no sense to leave it out.
Now, in terms of the easement as a fallback for the to lock in the recreation values, that you're emphasising to us, the I read with interest the Infinity decision that you referred us to.
I remember it well, so I was counsel arguing.
Yes, I noted that as well. it's in the learn something every day, eventually you get very wise. The court had two problems as I read it. The first was the agreement wasn't executed, which clearly in this case you have remedied. And the second was that it was a private contract. Now, as I read it, it was a private contract between Infinity and the council. I suppose, and the court said, well, the parties to the agreement could vary it, cancel it, do whatever they want with it at their option. So the question for you is, yes, clearly your easement is documented, but what's the difference in relation to the second problem that the Environment Court identified?
Well, the parties to this agreement are the Calumby Farms Limited and the Clue Gamer.
Yes.
Absent absent additional factors, then those two parties would cancel it. So we have included the contract's privity provisions, which would require not only would the parties have to agree to cancel it, but the council can enforce it. And the agreement cannot be cancelled without the council's consent.
Like, that's my issue. As I read what the court said in the Infinity case, there was a private contract with the council that the council could, ergo, the council, the court was mooting the possibility that the council could decide for whatever reason that came, that weighed with the council, that it could resile or change the agreement. So hence why I say, is there a material difference?
I take your point.
I'm not saying, of course, that the council would.
I know.
But the issue is, in terms of the concern that the court had, is this the same scenario?
One distinguishing factor, I guess, there is that there were two factors there. One, the agreement hadn't been signed, and it hadn't even been before the court. And the second was that the issues were raised, and as you'll have read from the quote, we addressed them by first of all putting the public park and revegetation into the plan rules, and secondly by saying we are not relying, there was another aspect of that deal, it was swimming pool. We are not relying on that as a possibility. And given that we weren't relying on that as a possible benefit, and given that we had cook the rest of it into the district plan rules. The court's judgment was almost arbiter in a sense. It wasn't coming to deal with that issue because they'd been dealt with. And even in an arbiter sense, the court said it would be better practice to have it in the rules than in a private deed. It expressed concern about the private deed because of those issues. It would be better practice to have it in the district plan. We put it into the district plan. The court never actually had to make a finding as to whether it would or would not rely on the private deed. It didn't go that far. It just said it's better practice. And I would acknowledge that it is better practice, which is why I'm desperately trying to get this stuff into the zone. But my point would be, sir, that that finding of the court does not rule out, did not rule out a private agreement. Did not rule out the possibility that it might have had to consider a private agreement and decide how much weight to put on it. It's not precluded. And in this case, my submission to you is that if this zone were confirmed on the basis of what is being proposed, then it must be open to this panel to accept that the possibility of the council agreeing to cancel all the public access aspects of this proposal is so remote as to be almost inconceivable. There's no possibility the council would do that. And quite frankly, in reality, when you lodge the subdivision application, you would try and put those evidence in favour of the council. And almost certainly the council would accept them. It's just that in this hearing, you can't make that decision for the council. I've struck this before. You can't say the council will accept those easements because it's an executive function of the council, it's another department of the council, it's not the planning department. That would be a jurisdiction. So in reality, if the zone were confirmed, those easements would almost certainly be in favour of council. The legal point of my submission is that the Environment Court doesn't preclude you taking into account this private agreement. You can give it such weight as you consider appropriate. Given the fact that the council is the controlling party, my submission, you can give it very considerable weight to the extent that you can rely on.
While you're thinking about redrafting your easement, one solution. You probably know far more property law than I do. In fact, I'm certain of it. It wouldn't be hard. Would a solution be to expand the privity clause to include the public at large? That would have the constraint that you wouldn't be able to further amend it.
Right, we have included a minor amendment clause.
Yes. But, so, as I say, ponder that.
Excellent idea, sir. It's short, I didn't think of this one. I think people came up with their idea.
Just, if I may.
Yes, sir.
Just while we're on the easement, I know this, that it specifically excludes the use of bicycles. You didn't mention it, and it was mentioned in the recreational discussion. I was just wondering.
It's quite like a cyclist.
Thought process behind the excluding the use of cyclists.
There's been a lot of debate about whether these should be walking tracks or walking and cycling tracks. At the moment, the preference of both the landowner and DOC, because we consulted DOC about this, is to, at this point in time, restrain it to walking. Although that part of the recreation management plan idea was that might change in the future. The bikes do a lot more damage. They significantly increase the maintenance requirements, and you have conflict issues. Mountain bikes coming down at high speed, and walkers coming up speed. It's not ideal. There was a lot of debate, but we were actually guided in that one by DOC, who were reasonably strong on not, at least at this stage,
keeping, not making it as a right to fighters, accepting the reality that you'd probably end up putting up signs and most people would abide by them and some people wouldn't. You're still going to get some bikes up there. Yeah. They're up there now. Mr. Clue's seen them.
Yeah. I would really apologise to Mr. Clue for cycling past his property without permission.
It is not a diamond that's issued at all.
Yeah.
At all.
Thank you.
And the fact, when we think about the drafting, that I might actually think about how to make that clearer. We were thinking that the recreation management plan would deal with those issues in detail. Maybe you have a couple of trails that you can bike and ones that you can't. I'm very open to flexibility on that.
Thank you.
Can I take you to paragraph 77? This is on the I want to get it on the record basis. You make a statement at subparagraph B. The panel can have comfort that a house will eventually be built on the approved building platform on Little Mount Iron. Why?
Hawthorne versus QLDC?
Yes, I thought you were going to tell me this. But on this case, hopefully you're not giving evidence from the bar.
I was a witness.
I know you were a witness there, but you're not a witness here.
I'm relying on the finding of the Environment Court in Hawthorne versus QLDC that if you have a pre-building platform, you can rely on the fact that it will be built on and it's part of the existing or future environment. Receiving environmental, whichever one of those two it is. But the Environment Court, that was specifically found that in this district, because of their value, if you have an approved building platform, it's going to be built on it.
Yes, I thought you were going to take me there. I also remember the quote from your evidence from the cooperative basin, that presumably you would tell me now that maybe that it's not identical to in Wanaka. But in that regard, we can have the same confidence.
Yes, I mean, that building, you have gone to it. It's a pretty amazing site. I think you can have comfort that it will be, that it will be built on, and that the logical outcomes will be built on. If in fact you can't get Little Mount Iron the site.
Yes. I want to just explore with you the consequences, as you say, that in terms of our Section 32 test, the objectives that any policy, any zoning rule has to achieve are fluid, to use your words, because there's still, we have some, obviously some on paper, and the respective hearing panels are still cogitating on what they think of the evidence and submissions they have heard. This also was a subject of a discussion I had with counsel for the council. The thought I had was that one of the things that the hearing panels, considering the objectives and panel policy, the objectives and policies, are striving to do is to ensure that those objectives and policies are the best means to achieve part two. Now, and that would suggest that the only way, at least in the panel's view, that those objectives and policies won't achieve part two is if there's a scope issue, and we've talked about the glitch as to how ONFs are defined and the potential inconsistency with the section 6B, or if it's a true exception, and we discussed with Council for the Council whether the position was sticky forest and the rather unique treaty overlay of that particular property might be the exception that proves the rule. But putting aside those two scenarios, is your submission that we can't rely on the recommended objectives and policies coming out of the other streams and have to go back to part two?
My first submission is that in this case the answer doesn't matter.
That's always a very good position to be in.
Because, and I've looked at that, we are proposing site-specific objectives and policies. I went back and looked at the latest version of the Rural Lifestyle Zone objectives and policies, and that came to the conclusion in my mind that specific ones fit them, no change is necessary. I mean, we are dealing with, the issues we're dealing with are amply addressed at the strategic level and down. So I don't think this case is going to raise any issue of a higher up inconsistency. So I don't think we need to go there.
And if we conclude,
if I'm wrong on that,
if we don't accept that submission,
question was, can we ignore the, should we say, latest draft district plan and go straight to part two? I'm not sure you make that choice, because what I'm essentially saying is, despite how the panel has chosen to structure the hearings, please don't take that as criticism of the job, which is reasonable to manage. You have to treat this submission as a single submission, and all of these submissions being put to you, and at some point you have to sit down and make sure that everything's consistent. You've got fluid district plan objectives and policies. It's complicated by fluid regional statements, objectives and policies. And then you ultimately must go back, and I'll come back to part two in a minute, but you must go back to part two in assessing all of those. So what I think you can't do is each panel make individual decisions absent the wider consideration. But at some point, you must be getting around the table as if all of these submissions had been heard in one hearing and you were just approaching everything from the beginning and make a unified decision. I can't see how you can avoid that.
I suppose where I'm going is that you said we must go back to part two. My question is, is this a King Salmon position? We only go back to part two if we think there's an issue as to whether the objectives and policies recommended by the other streams don't give effect to it, or may not give effect to it.
No, I'm saying that regardless of anything else, whatever King Salmon says, in this case you don't have settled objectives and policies at the district plan or regional plan level. That is part of the foundation. I am going to ask, go slightly sideways, your part two question. I will seek leave at the end to respond in writing, because I take it as a significant question and I don't want to do it on the feet. So you will get that, and in whatever time you allow.
Well, perhaps the easiest thing is if you could add this question in rather than.
Sorry, as I understand it, effectively, are you saying, well,
does the panel look at part two, go down the hierarchy, look at part two, settle its objectives and policies, and then when it gets to making this decision, it only has to go one step up.
Correct.
That's what you're saying.
Yes. That's the question.
That's the question. I understand the question.
No, that's not what I'm saying. That's the question.
I understand the question.
In relation to your discussion of Section 6B, I'm a very general question. Pigeon Bay is about landscapes. Does Pigeon Bay apply to ONS? And is there a case that says that?
I need to go and see if there's a case that says that. Six B versus both.
Yes, and then
I would submit that it would be. I'll see if we can find a case. But absent the case, I would submit the starting point. Surely that very well considered set of factors must be relevant. As a determination of ONS. And in fact, I think my counsel's reminding me, I think we go back to C108099, there were findings of ONS and ONLs. In C108099, he addressed Pigeon Bay criteria, and then later in the judgment, he made specific finding of facts about some areas were ONX and some areas were ONLs. There's a list of ONX in one paragraph of that judgment. Because he actually identified ONX on the Wakatipu side, and there was a note saying we will have to come back to the Wanaka ONX in a future hearing, because he hadn't heard about Wanaka. So in C108099, he definitely started off with what is outstanding, what is, the whole thing, Pigeon Bay factors, and then that flowed into specific findings of fact about ONLs and separately ONX.
Well, I might have to reread that case yet again.
But he definitely made specific findings on ONS, and he did not apply any separate criteria or analysis to get there.
I suspect you're right. Let's leave that one.
Pretty confident. I can see the list in my mind.
Now, in terms of the question I asked Ms. Scott when she opened, whether she could point me to a case applying that was even remotely comparable to the nature of the case you're putting to me, which I characterised as an environmental compensation case, but this one can hang up on the label, in a plan setting as opposed to a resource consent, you pointed us to Infinity, which implies the ability to take account of positive features of a zoning proposal. But as you say, can you add to Ms. Hill's list of jobs, find a case for me that is a little closer, because Infinity, as you said, was about provision of open space within a zone, and to me it doesn't get very close at all to what you're now proposing, which, as you say, has some unique features which suggest there may not be a case. If you're presenting a unique case, by definition, there will be no precedent. But if you could have another look and see if what you can come up with, see if you can come up with something closer.
Can I clarify, sir, is your question about ability to take into account positive effects full stop, or is it ability to take into account positive effects outside design?
I don't think it's necessary outside the zone. It's as compensation for adverse effects.
So that was a specific statement of what Infinity implied.
Yes.
Right.
Now, you talked in the context of your paragraph 120 about Mr. Davis's reasoning. Mr. Davis raised a specific point, which is that the enforcement order made by the court includes replanting, tending, and not removing vegetation which appears to be on one of the house sites, which would seem to create something of a problem. And do you have any, is that factually correct? Or do you have evidence that it is or is not? And if it is factually correct, do you have a legal response?
I think it's probably factually correct. I'll check that, but I think I'll let you know it isn't, but at the moment I think it's probably factually correct. Secondly, and I think as I've made one of my legal submissions, the entire case was put on, as it put to you, on the basis that that clearance didn't happen. Accepting that it was illegal, couldn't rely on it.
Yeah, I understand the point. The specific issue is, if you have an enforcement order that you must leave the plants there, does that preclude the ability? There appears to be an inconsistency with the zone, at least as regards that house site. Is it as simple as that you apply to vary or delete the enforcement order?
It's interesting. I'm going to ask Williams to come back to enlighten that, only because I'm not sufficiently up with the district court procedures to answer you on the fly as to the interrelationship between a district court proceeding and a district plan hearing. And the district court proceeding is specifically addressing a breach and reinstating what was there before. My feeling is that that cannot be a bar, given that this hearing assumes that planting is there, and even if it has to be temporarily replanted, which I trust it will have to, I can't see that can be a bar to a separate proceeding in this court saying that you can remove vegetation under the RMA for the purposes that are here.
But you understand that there does appear to be a mismatch.
I understand.
You take a point, in effect, criticising Ms. Mousop for advancing views about ecology, about which she is not qualified.
And hadn't read out ecology.
That my reading of, like, if Ms. Mousop was commenting on the ecological significance of the vegetation, then clearly you're right. I don't know whether she was or not, but what she was clearly doing was commenting on the appearance of the alterations, the very vegetation that you're proposing, or that Dr. Lloyd's proposing, and that you're advocating to us.
I mean, the visual appearance.
The visual appearance.
I didn't criticise that.
So I just, that's the question. So you say you accept that that's fairly within her and indeed within Mr. Davis.
That's a visual landscape issue. What I was critiquing was her weighing the ecological benefits against landscape benefits without reading evidence.
Now, I just wanted to give you a chance to respond to this. Paragraph 157. The VROA approach appears to be unique to the Allenby land, hasn't been imposed on any other landowner joining the new instance, Cadrona Valley Road. Could you not acting, you may not be aware that Mr. Barr is in fact recommending a VRA on Cadrona Valley Road as part to preserve the entrance to the town, and whether that would have a bearing on the submission you're making to us.
Well, my submission was based on reading the notified maps. I went and checked to see if there was any anywhere else. So my position is that at the time the plan was notified, shall we say, it was unique. It was unique to...
I'm not criticising you for it, but on the basis that everything changes...
Yeah, everything changes, yeah. I could probably go and find five other roads entering the urban areas in the district, or 10 or 20, where these recommendations aren't being made.
So you're just unlucky you picked Cadrona Valley Road?
Yes, actually. Next, I looked at the map, looked at Cadrona Valley Road, didn't go any further. That's all.
Okay. The well, I'm sure the other commissioners would be happy to pose any of my questions on your submissions, but Commissioner Rowe, is it?
Before the morning tea break, I think I heard you say a comment to the effect that consent as a controlled activity would be required to establish new dwellings within the zone. When I read Mr. White's provisions, I didn't think that was the case. So did I hear you wrong, or is this a matter I should take up with Mr. White later to show me the rule?
It's whatever the rule is that applies in the rural lifestyle zone.
Yeah. Okay.
I thought it was controlled, but there's a debate about that actually now. I think controlled or restricted discretion. But the building platforms are intended, it's a rural living zone.
Yeah.
The intention is that the rules which apply in the rural living zone apply here.
Okay.
Whether that's controlled or restricted discretion.
Most of my questions relate to Mr. White, but what I want to put to you relates to the nature of the relief sought as it relates to the extent of Section 32A analysis that might be required, and what appears to be the absence of any such documentation from the package of information relating to it. And the question is, were we to find ourselves in support of the relief sought, is it your expectation that we would write a 32AA report on your behalf? Or have I missed something? All I found was five paragraphs saying Section 32 summary, Mr. Watt's evidence.
I can make you on that after 10 seconds.
No, that's right. But related to that theme, one of the things that was of interest to me, and again I think it's fair to put it to you rather than Mr. White, one of the proposed provisions for the initial subdivision requires the IMP, the Implementation Management Plan, and it sets out a whole range of requirements, including for the protection areas, a fair amount of work on a pretty big amount of area, and I was interested to understand the extent to which that has been costed out, such that we can have confidence that 15 households could actually afford the burden that is being imposed on them. Or whether, in fact, we might expect the non-complying subdivision consent to come in saying, actually, it costs too much, we need more houses.
The primary expense is the developers, in the sense of having to do, should we say, initial eradication.
Mm-hmm.
What is required for the protection areas on an ongoing basis is basically maintaining what is put in place. Now, maintaining, once you've gone in and taken out every wilding economy you can find, and every other bad example of whatever other plant pests are there, and once you have done whatever pest control is considered appropriate, seems there's a bit of a
interesting issue about rabbits because it's not the most simply beneficial, then the ongoing cost is merely maintaining that.
There's a method proposed that says effective control and ongoing management of animal and plant pests.
Yes.
And I'm just asking whether or not, given the extent of the area proposed, there's been any analysis of what that would actually be for those 15 households. So, for instance, we might want to have confidence that the methods proposed to us can actually implement the policies put to us. Again, where's the Section 32 analysis?
Well, we have no cost assessment. B, I'll be honest, that has been on the basis that ongoing control of those things, once you've got the first lot done.
Understood. The assumption there.
Isn't actually that complicated.
Okay. Look, I'm happy to leave my other questions to Mr. White, but I imagine you might have a few things to say as well. Thanks, sir.
Rest of hands.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon, Mr. Hoffman. I've just got some clarifications which cross over between your role as Council and probably Mr. White. In terms of the mechanism that is proposed for protecting parts of Mount Iron through which public walkways will be created, that is understood to form a part of the structure plan. Now, what I'd like to understand is whether that mechanism effectively precludes further development or whether it leaves it open to other planning consent processes. I.e., does the currently undeveloped and proposed undeveloped area of Mount Iron get locked up in perpetuity or not?
The rules as currently provided don't address that. And I'll have to think about when you made that point about whether they could. It's probably fair to say that what is currently being relied upon is the fact that the balance of the land will have ONF status, most of it will have SNA status, and the likelihood of being able to consent and there'll be a lack of potential positives because ecological management is taken care of, public walkways are taken care of. The likelihood of being able to consent any additional dwellings on that land would be remote, to say the least. That's the current position.
Well, aren't we in a position right now where we are considering development on ONE land?
Yes.
So what would the difference be between what we're considering now versus what might be possible in the future?
The difference is that, and I didn't use to you know, say this in opening, but it's generally accepted, and I'm quite happy to say it, that you only get consent for something on an ONF in exceptional cases. We believe we're putting forward an exceptional case. And that exceptional case, you know, the houses on their own wouldn't get you there. What gets you there, if we get there, is the ecological control, particularly the public access, and all those benefits for the community which justify whatever adverse effects would arise through considering the houses. Looking forward, and absent a control in the zone, which I will think about that, you would somebody else coming along to get consent for another house would have to put forward an equally exceptional case. Perhaps the obvious example is Little Mount Iron got consent for that house that was approved on the basis of the ecological management plan, which applied to the whole property. And I'm not sure I need to go back into that. That consent might even have a no further development covenant. Given that this zone, if implemented, would, can we say, use up all the positives. Ecological control is all there, public access is all there,
I'm sitting here trying to think how somebody could possibly mount another exceptional case on top of all of that, and I'm struggling.
Well, that's not really the focus of my question. It's more whether the mechanism that is proposed at this stage did lock up that land in perpetuity, and you're going to
come back. The answer is no, because we have been relying on what I've just said.
Yeah.
I will review the rules to see if that can be improved.
Now, the submission made by Alan B and attached maps and aerial photos of various kinds do helpfully include maps that show existing and proposed walking trails. I'm just looking at the moment at one, which is called Mount Iron Park Proposed Trail, which is the Paterson Pit overlaid aerial photo. And it appears in various places, right? This particular one is I think it's A to, I think it's Mr. White's president. But really, as long as you know what I'm referring to, you can find a copy. This is the one that's got various coloured notations on it.
Is that with the yellow trunks?
With the yellow arrow showing the access points.
So that would be Paterson Pitt's sheet, all right. Looking at the bottom left.
I think it's all 9.
Oh, 9.
Oh, 9.
Okay. So we're talking about that particular.
Okay, and 9. Now, 9 Park proposed trail.
Yeah. Now, what I wasn't clear about, right, is what status, what gives them the status of existing DOC or QLDC trails? Are they legally protected at the moment? And if so, how are they legally protected? This is the green one.
Yeah, the green dot pumps are legally protected. And if you look at that map at the bottom where it says SH6 access, there's a green dot and one goes eventually upwards, dives off into Allenby Place, then it continues going up, then it cuts another green dotted one which comes in from Rob Roy Lane access.
Yes.
Then it goes right up the top of Mount Eye. That is, most of that is a easement in favour of DOC. From Allenby Place, going back from the car park across to Allenby Place, and then up the zigzag to the top of Mount Eye is an existing legally registered easement in favour of Department of Conservation. The little leg that comes from Rob Roy Lane access, the little green dot that comes across there and joins the other trail, is a legally registered easement in favour of the council.
Okay.
Yeah. And third one, top right, from Hidden Hills access, that dotted line there, which has got a yellow colouring on it for some reason, running across and ending near Bravo.
Yes, got that.
That's a legally registered easement in favour of the council.
Okay.
So those are existing. Those ones, which is stated in the legend as existing DOC QLDC trails,
yes,
are legally in place.
Okay, thank you, that's helpful. Something I couldn't sort of quite get to from what we had, so thank you for that. I had another question. I'm not sure whether Commissioner McLeod's got any in the meantime.
I can ask a question, it follows on from it's helpful to hear that you're going to be casting your mind into reviewing the rules to see how the protection of can be enhanced. And my question is to do with the BRA, and when is a BRA, and when is it just putting off another bite of the cherry? There is a BRA that's existing adjacent to State Highway 84, and we're now asking that it be
reviewed for, I think it was Section 8 or Part 8 of the Allenby Farms plan, and being replaced with 5.6 hectares. Is that then going to come back to, let's have a look at this one, know what I mean?
If I can separate out those two, if we deal with the one on the lower slope of Mount Iron, that's just, I think the legal submission said, Allenby doesn't expect anybody to be able to get consent to build on it. It's that lovely, that little pastoral slope at the bottom, it's probably the most impossible to build on. The thought was, if it been at the moment it's discretionary, Allenby's quite happy to say, well, let's make it non-compliant, because the BRA is non-compliant. So that the status of that lower land is goes from being very, very difficult to build on to almost impossible to build on, due to its location and visibility from the town itself. It's just really doubling up the protection as a part of protecting our island. Okay. It's kind of a bonus. If it didn't happen, you'd probably never get to see the build there anyway. But it's just making it stronger. Entirely separately, is the BRA alongside the road. Mr. Lewis gave evidence, he didn't know where it came from or why it was imposed. I mean, you can probably guess why it might have been imposed, but no one can find any documentary evidence of how it got there or when it got there. And if you think about all of the Allenby property, if there was one place where you might get consent to buy a house, if you wanted to, that's probably the only area where you might have a chance, to be honest.
This is the adjacent to the state highway.
Adjacent to the state highway. So there's a bit of a personal thing there from the Clue family saying, well, why is this restriction on our land? Why shouldn't we be able to apply for a house there? But Allenby is also signalling that, and again, quite open about it, there may be another stage of development there. It would require a plan change. It hasn't been thought about. I think it would be honest if you could ask Mr. Clue, but he would say yes, it probably has potential, especially given the interest of Wanaka has now shifted out to the puzzling world, and that maybe in the future something might happen. But anything significant would require a plan change, and the whole, everything would have to be reviewed again. But he's saying, well, if we wanted to put a house there, somewhere in that land, why is it so pristine that it's got a BRA? Why can't we just come along with the discretionary regime, the district plan, and fight our case? Although, again, no specific plans.
So, the
I just get this from Mr. Clinton not at that, because I'm almost giving evidence there, but he's not.
And the further BRA and, another district plan hearing 10 years from now, or whatever, or a plan change, then suggesting that BRA is, and you can see that potentially might happen in the future?
Which one are you talking about?
This is the 5.6, the attention to swap on the lower slopes of Mount Iron, which is...
Theoretically, yes. But we're actually sitting here volunteering a BRA there for valid reasons to protect the lower slopes of an ONF. As part of the ONF, you can always come along in the future and ask for a plan change. Is it possible? Yes. Is it likely? No. Is it intended? No. Can't speak.
Anything's changed. Everything changes.
Everything does change. Yeah. Which is why I'm going to actively, and I actually, the more I think about it, I don't think there's any problem including a provision in the zone rules that would lock up that land. But any provision in the district plan is open to change in 10 years as well. The difference, of course, between the two is that one is on an ONF and the one beside the highway is, funny bit of rural land rapidly becoming surrounded by urban development.
Yeah, I will test the assumption that the entrance to to Wanaka has moved back to and hopefully test that with
Whoever expressed the opinion. I think there's an issue about moving there, because when three parks develop, there's going to, everyone accepts there's going to be a big intersection upgrade where three parks comes out.
Except potentially for the person who's going to pick the intersection. I'll debate that or ask, test that assumption, because when you do, everyone comes in that road quite regularly, and it is a very rural feel right the way until you get to essentially that Anderson Road roundabout. And I do accept that three parks will change it, but it's how you approach it, how you're coming into looking at that. And
the only point I'm making, Commissioner, is that's an entire, that's an issue all on its own. It's not in any way related to everything else.
No.
So, kind of, there's the zone, there's one thing, the Mount Iron zone. The BRA at the bottom of the slope is an entirely separate issue. It's been offered, take it or not, okay, really. And the BRA beside the highway is an entirely separate issue on which you'll make a decision.
Mr. Goldsmith, I've gone back to my notes and located the question that I had. I would just like to understand, if you can help me, and you may not, whether there are any consent conditions relating to public or public land or access over parts of Mount Iron previously, perhaps in relation to the Hidden Hills subdivision or prior to that. The one that's identified at stage 3, which was before Hidden Hills. And as I said, you may not be able to answer it, and if not, I can ask Mr. Clue.
Ms. Clue will be able to answer that.
Yeah, alright.
I have a feeling that one up the top, that little one up the top, might have been as part of Hidden Hills, but.
He has referred to that being created at that time, but I was looking for. Just a little bit of clarity over how it happened, whether it was in relation to the.
I'll ask you to explain how those existing QLDC dock easements actually came about.
Yes. Okay. So thank you, Mr.
Chair. Any more for any more? I wonder, Mr. Goldsmith, if we could hear Mr. Clues. I assume you're going to refer to the client first. Hear Mr. Clues' summary, and then we'll reply to it.
Just one point before you do. So if I can just finish off on one issue, the clearance issue. Apart from the legal point, which you've asked me about the complex, we have sent to the Secretary of Sentencing the agreed summary of the facts.
Thank you.
When you read it, I don't think you'll find much significance, but it's there. You have a comment on the debate about that, and I'll leave it there. I've reread the sentencing notes, and I just draw your attention in particular. So I assume you must have those, because you said you'd read them. Paragraphs 22 to 25. There was obviously some debate about the ecological significance. At the end of the day, that was a case where vegetation had been cut down. It's a no-fault. Strict liability. It's a strict liability offence, so there was never any issue about the fact that there had been a breach, that steps had to be taken, and there were some statements about the ecological significance. Dr. Lloyd didn't quite agree with the council's person, and that's actually recorded in paragraphs 22 to 25. In my submission, any statement of ecological significance arising out of that separate judgment in a different jurisdiction has little bearing here, and that you should make a judgment on ecological significance on the evidence you've been presented and whatever questions you may ask of Dr. Lloyd. Given there was a guilty plea there, and given there was a proposal to replant it anyway, it wasn't, shall we say, an issue of competing sets of facts or anything else. The bush had been cut down, it had to be replanted, it had some significance to a greater or lesser degree. It was at the time inside of another funny CNA. that was the background to the judgment, but in my submission that case has little bearing or significance, apart from possibly the one that I can be.
Refer you to paragraph 51A. Yes, Rosalind McGuire, along with reporting too.
Right. I accept that statement, sir. That it doesn't detract from the fact that you know, it hadn't had the examination that has happened that has been happened here, and I'd be happy for you to quiz Dr. Lloyd as to his view of the psychological significance.
I will. I think we have time here, we'll just close somewhere.
So, Mr. Clerk, if you could read out your evidence, I think you can start at paragraph 2.
In paragraph 21 of my primary evidence, I stated that there was originally very little Carnuga cover over Mount Ryan, and in particular on the northern sides. I would like to clarify that point. Before the Clue family purchased the Umbe farm, it is my understanding that there was reasonably extensive Manuka, not Carnuga, cover on Mount Ryan. However, in the 1950s and 60s, some form of blight killed most of the Manuka, leaving Mount Ryan relatively bare. Over time, new Carnuga replaced the marker. I presume that is because the Carnuga was not resistant to the blight than the marker. I also presume that there must have been mixed Carnuga and marker originally, because the Carnuga regenerated naturally, and even now there is some marker mixed up with the predominant Carnuga. Number 4, however, I confirm that when the Clue family bought Allenby Farm, there was not much of either.
Let me just stop, Mr. Clue. I've just discovered that to get this copy to the phone, that hasn't been attached there. And then the journey here is about to find an email into your electronic.
Thank you.
I attach a copy of 3 photographs taken in 1966, which shows some remnant areas of marker and otherwise areas generally free of tree growth. Those 3 photographs were all taken within the area of the proposed Mount Iron Park Rural Lifestyle Zone. I would like to emphasise the point made in my primary evidence about the need for ongoing active land management to control wild conifers. When the Clue family purchased Allenby Farm, there were a number of mature conifers which provided a seed source. They have been removed. Over the last 30 years, I've spent a considerable amount of time removing wilding seedlings, either by hand or with chainsaw if they're too big to pull out by hand. This is one of those tasks I've always done from time to time when time was available, usually in the spring or autumn when the soil tends to be a little softer. I've always seen that as part of my responsibility as owner and manager of the land. I am concerned about what may happen in the future. I cannot predict who might end up owning this land in the future, but there is at least a reasonable chance that any such future owner will not have the same attitude towards land management as I do as a farmer of the land. I understand that there is nothing in the district plan that will require any future landowner to remove a wilding conifers. I believe there is no doubt that wilding conifers would end up covering Mount Iron if they are not adequately controlled. This district plan review process has caused the Clue family to sit down and actually have a serious discussion about the future of Mount Ryan. We did not previously have any specific plans because we have always been occupied in development of other parts of Allenby Farm, as detailed in my primary evidence. We had not really given thought to what the appropriate future of Mount Ryan should be and how to ensure that future. This led to the realisation on our part that a choice had to be made, both by the Clue family and by the Wanaka community. The current situation cannot be allowed to drift. The Clue family has developed a concept of a future potential public park. A lot of effort and expense has gone into creating the possibility of that future vision, including Little Round Island, just for that purpose. We have obtained legal advice about how to provide a funding method to enable that vision to be realised without cost to the community. I believe the Wanaka community now needs to make a decision. The Clue family will then have to live with whatever decision is ultimately made and make its own plans accordingly. I understand that there may be a legal difficulty, including Mount Iron, in the proposed zone revisions. I assure this panel that if the zone is confirmed and if Mount Iron is developed in accordance with the zone provisions, Little Mount Iron will be included in the development as intended, regardless of whether that is a district plan requirement or not. The only reason LNB purchased Little Mount Iron was for that purpose. Finally, I would like to comment on the building restriction area proposed to be applied to LNB land adjoining the state highway. My perception of what the district plan review proposes is that the majority of LNB land will be sterilised by ONF plus SNA status, and the small balance will be sterilised by BRO status. LNB accepts the ONF status, but does not believe that the BRA status is reasonable. I accept and understand that any application to build a building within the proposed BRA could be challenging. However, I believe that LNB should have the right to make an application and have that application judged on its merits.
Now, Mr. Clee, before I ask you to answer any questions, I ask you to direct your attention to the plan. What the Commissioner Hudson was referring to previously, it's the Mount Iron proposed trails, Mount Iron Park proposed trails plan sheet 9. And if I can direct your attention to, firstly, to the Hidden Hills access, and there's a QLDC easement running across from Hidden Hills access to the dock land just between proposed platforms 12 and 11. Could you advise the panel how that came about, that easement?
The Hidden Hills subdivision was for some time had been zoned rural residential, and we felt that any residents and others in that area, future areas, should have access to the dock estate, and that seemed to be a logical way to put it. There was no requirement, we just thought, well, that made sense. It seemed sort of a no-brainer, I think, yeah.
Okay, and
just before you go on, Mr. Fleet, so what you're saying is that was part of the subdivision proposal?
Could somebody clarify that for me? We gave it as part of the subdivision,
but
there was no requirement.
Like it never got to the stage of being a requirement because you offered it up front.
No.
Thank you.
And how about the primary dock trail from the SHX access that zigzags up Mount Iron to the top? Where did that come from?
The primary dock trail. The primary dock trail was always there, where it is shown, but it's our time going back over 50 years.
Was it then you bought the property?
It was then we bought the property, but there wasn't an easement when we bought the property, and there was quite a long, lengthy period of negotiation with what is now DOC, predecessor of DOC, etc., as to formalising its status.
It wasn't an informal trial, and you formalised it with DOC or Lexus, isn't it?
Yes, that's probably the short answer.
And was it the little leg that comes in from Rob Roy Lane, the QDC leg that comes in from Rob Roy Lane and connects to the dock trail? Where'd that come?
So, the northernmost area of our LNB subdivision, so what we call stages 16 and 17, we decided at the time that rather than have them walk all the way or ride, go all the way around to access the dock trail, it seemed to be logical that they access the dock trail from their part of the subdivision.
So it was proposed as part of that subdivision?
It was proposed as part of that. I think the answer to that is yes. It wasn't a requirement, but it was proposed as part of that subdivision.
Could you just answer any questions, please?
Thank you, Mr. Goldsmith. We'll adjourn the lunch back at 2 to ask Mr. Cruz a question.
Right.